It's time to begin.
Yes.
I see some of us have made it back from Thanksgiving. Good to see you all. We left off on Genesis chapter 46 is where we're picking up this morning. I don't know that we'll finish. Based on our previous pace, I suppose we'll probably go on this for 2 weeks. And then after we finish, we're going to look at some of the themes, some of the prophecies that carry on into the New Testament. Look at Hebrews. And we'll continue that through the end of the year. And then we'll start a new class at the first of the year. So that's the plan here. Where we left off was talking about Joseph providing. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, yes, in a sense, yeah, Joseph did provide. And it says Joseph provided, but who really provided? God provided for Jacob. God provided for that family that goes all the way back that he had made the promises to, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and is carrying that through Joseph. So, yeah, it was very interesting. The family coming all back together. And here in chapter 46, we see not just the reunion of the brothers, where Joseph had broken down in front of the brothers. Jacob was still hesitant. he didn't, I mean, you think about it. If you've believed your son has been dead for years, he's likely long given up hope that his son's alive. I mean, it's been a long time. He just accepted it from the beginning that Joseph was killed by an animal or whatever. So whenever he's told to go back, oh, well, no, Joseph is alive. He didn't really want to believe it at first. And so God tells Jacob, has to tell Jacob, no, go ahead and go on down. I'm not sure why exactly Jacob was so hesitant. If he was thinking it was a trap, if he was thinking that, you know, God's provided for me up until this point on my own without having to go to Egypt or go to someone else. Really, it doesn't matter what the reasoning, what his reasoning was. He just didn't really feel like that's where he wanted to go. Yeah, but God tells him to go, and true to nature, when God says go with this family, they pretty well go. They pretty well do just what he says. And God gives him some assurances, promises. It speaks to him here. Chapter 46, verse 1, Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba, offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the visions and said, in the visions of the night, and said, Jacob, Jacob. He said, here I am. He said, I am the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt. I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the carts with which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So they sent their livestock, their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt. Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons' sons, his daughters, and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now these were the names. We won't go through the names. But when you get down through all of the people who were there, verse 26, it says, all the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons and his wives, were 66 persons in all. The sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2 persons, and all the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. So if you include everybody all together of Israel's line here, we got 70 people here. And we'll talk a bit about that in a minute. But what we see here in this chapter, besides the lineage here, is Now, God made some assurances to Jacob. Well, what did God promise Jacob here? Yeah, and he tells him not to fear, you know, that they're going to go up and I will surely bring you up again. So that they're going to go, but that they will be able to leave. And so, I'm not exactly sure what he was afraid of, but this might have been part of it. Might have been that he was afraid that if they went down to Egypt that they would never leave. But what I do know about this promise is this is a fulfillment of the promise that was been passed on from forefather to son that, yeah, you're going to inherit the land of Egypt. Canaan. You're going to inherit Canaan. And so when he promises that he's going to leave again and that he'll get to see his son, that's enough. That's enough for him. And so he's willing to go. I think it's important because, you know, we've kind of seen this throughout. God has reassured and reaffirmed his covenant. I don't know if you'd say reestablish, but reminds them that, you know, he's going to be faithful to his promises. And it's not, you know, that the plan has changed. The plan has always been what the plan always was. But sometimes God's timetable isn't exactly what we expect. God had promised that they were going to inherit the land eventually. And he's saying here essentially, yeah, you're still going to leave and go up and inherit the land. But this is where God wanted him to go for now. And I suppose to me the reason that they're going to Egypt is pretty obvious. There's a severe famine in the land. So could Jacob or Joseph have provided for 70 people during a severe famine all on their own? That would be pretty arrogant, I would say. From the mindset of a farmer or even a rancher, you know, you really rely even in normal circumstances on God for the rain. And when you think about all the things that are just beyond your control. I think about that way more now than I have in the past. You know, I got a little one right there, and MK had to get the booger sucker out this morning because she's not breathing too good. And I'm one of those parents who's always kind of, are you still breathing? Are you still breathing? And I said a prayer on the way to church today, you know, help her to keep breathing. Because, you know, there's so much in life that you can't control. And you just have to give it to God. You can't really force life to go the way that you want it. It would be a tragedy if something were to happen to her. But, I mean, I can't spend every waking second worried about that. I have to go on. I have to live my life. Trust that God's going to take care of me. And when you think about this Thanksgiving, I got together with my mom's side of the family, which is tradition for our family, and everybody was there, and it was like, wow, everyone's actually here this year. We don't even know if that's going to happen again. So we took a picture, and there definitely wasn't 70 of us, but I remember thinking, man, people keep getting married and having kids. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Well, the promise line from Abraham down to Joseph here has gotten up all the way up to 70. I have a hard time, you know, just putting food on the table for our family of five there. I can't imagine being able to afford doing it for 70 all on my own. And, you know, okay, you know, your children grow up and they're adults. They can take care of themselves. They can provide for their own kids. But I think what we see here is a lesson that I take out of this is really when you think about the severity of the famine, again, I don't know Jacob's reasons for not wanting to go, but the reality was, God, this was, we, and we can see it now, you know, they may not have understood why everything was happening then, but God put them through all this stuff where Joseph was sent to prison, sent off to Egypt, sold into slavery, and he put them there so that God could provide for them. Not so that Joseph could flex his own might and show just how capable he was of taking care of everybody all by himself. When you think about it, how did Joseph have the wherewithal to stock up all the grain for all those years before the famine came? Well, God told him to do it. That wasn't his idea that he just, you know what, I think it would be a good idea if I just started putting aside some food. That wasn't his idea. That was God's idea. So who provided all this? And could he have done it on his own? I really doubt he would have come up with this plan to stock up all this grain. In fact, I know he wouldn't have, without God telling him, hey, there's going to be a famine. You need to stock up. So could they have? I seriously doubt it to the point where I'd say no. That's just not possible in a severe famine with no preparations, with no advance warning, with no help from God. Could they have done this on their own? No, they couldn't have. And you know, God is promising them, you know, if you go down there, I'm still going to fulfill my promises to you. Really what I see is God's protective hand watching over this family. He knows how he's going to fulfill this promise. They may not know. They may not know how it's going to go, just like we don't know how our lives are going to turn out. But certainly what I see here is God is the one who's taking care of them and has been doing that through his providence this whole time. All right. Any thoughts on that? Go ahead, Blake.
Jacob was scared to leave. As I was just thinking about it, you know, kind of going through your question, I think he was scared to leave because this is the land that God told Abraham to go to, just like God's going to tell Jacob to go to Egypt. God said, go into the land that I will show you. That's going to be the land that's been, he's inherited through the blessing and the birthright. That's home for him, and he's seen the blessings of God. And I think that's the only way that he would have gone, is God showing him in a vision or a dream that you need to go to Egypt because the land, seed, nation promise that I made to Abraham, that's going to continue on in Egypt. And I think that's the only way Jacob would have left home to go to Egypt.
Yeah, he's been following God up until this point. I think it's an admirable thing that, well, for whatever, we don't know the reason exactly why, but just because somebody walks up to Jacob and tells him, hey, we should do this, hey, we should do that, he wasn't going to do it unless God told him to do it. So to his credit, we do know that, and that's a good thing. That's says something about Jacob. Many people, they kind of just go with the crowd, conventional wisdom, or whatever everyone else is saying. Jacob wasn't going to do anything unless it was God who told him. And I'm sure he learned that lesson through all the years and all the things he had been through. Okay, good thought. Yes, go ahead.
God instructed Jacob what to do. And one of the main things through all this is Jacob was faithful enough to do. So now he's traveled all over this. And he's been faithful, so he has the provisions that he needs.
Yeah, I mean, God has always promised that he's going to be faithful to us. And if that we're faithful to him, you know, even if we falter from time to time or make mistakes, he will be faithful to us. If we're faithful to him, he'll be faithful to us. Good point. Anything else? I thought I saw another hand back there. Nope. Okay. So how does the reunion here go at the end of the chapter? Let's just go ahead and read it. Verse 28. Then he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way to Goshen. They came before the land. Joseph made ready his chariot, went up to Goshen to meet his father, Israel. He presented himself and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, now let me die since I have seen your face because you are still alive. Joseph said to his brothers, to his father's household, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, my brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land have come with me. The men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. They have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you, says, what's your occupation? That you shall say, your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth and even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. So that last part kind of flows into the next chapter. I wanted to read it because it's important to what happens next in the story. But as for the question, how does the reunion go? Well, I guess it goes about as you would expect it. I cannot imagine being separated from Titus for years and years and years, thinking he was dead, and then getting to see him again. Even trying to think about it would be just overwhelming. And so the statement that was made by Jacob is, I can die now. I guess in the colloquial sense, it'd be like, well, I guess I've seen everything now. You know, it's kind of the feeling of not just I've seen it all, but now I can die happy. You know, now my life is complete. You know, I can rest well knowing that, my son is still alive and that my family is going to be provided for in all of this famine and everything, that God has taken care of it, even beyond, I suppose. I don't know if Jacob had become bitter or grumpy from losing his son. I do know that he never lost his faith. And here, I think that's a comment that was made earlier, that God is faithful to reward those promises. That's kind of fulfilled here, that his faith is rewarded in this moment, that he gets to see the end plan that God had for him to provide for him from the start. And, this is just, for a good while, Joseph fell on his neck and wept. I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine everything that's going through all the emotions there. But what we see here is that as we read that latter part, they're going to kind of be separate. And, it's kind of interesting the way they end up being slaves in Egypt, enslaved in Egypt like everyone else. We'll see that through the end, that Joseph's dealings with everybody else was kind of, okay, if you can't feed your livestock because there's no pasture, there's no food out there, there's nothing for you to do. If you sell it to me, then we'll give you grain to eat and to plant and to survive on if you basically, sell all you have and serve me. And eventually, what we would see is that Joseph is forgotten, and even the children of Israel are enslaved as well. But at first, that's kind of not the arrangement at first, is it? At first, they're kind of separate. They're kind of doing their own thing, close by, in the land of Goshen. But here it says that to the Egyptians, that shepherds were an abomination. I guess for some, at least for the elites, that they kind of look down on that profession and, oh, we're higher than that. And it's just kind of interesting to me. Usually when I think of the term abomination, I think of that as a religious term, not something that I would put on somebody secular, that, oh, this is an abomination before them. But, even the godless, even those who don't follow God, may have something that's an anathema to them. I can't even say that right. That is just totally unacceptable, that they look down on, that they hate. And so that was kind of the situation here. I thought that was interesting because, on that theme of God provides, well, if the Egyptians hate shepherds so much, then why are they going to let them stay there? That's kind of always been something that I was like, well, how is that possible? If they don't like them, then why do they, you know, have favor in their eyes? And, you know, I didn't see any lying about it. Maybe there was some lying that went on in the past that, oh, well, I just will leave this fact out. I'm not going to tell them that. Well, they probably would have found out anyways when they saw livestock and all that. But what we're going to see here is they don't get the same deal everyone else gets, at least not at first here in the land of Goshen. So any thoughts as we go here into chapter 47? And so the thing that I find really interesting is as we get into chapter 47, they just go ahead and tell Pharaoh, hey, you know, they're introduced here, and that the deal that's made is, they said to Pharaoh, verse 4, we have come to dwell in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, and for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them the chief herdsmen over my livestock. So to me, with the immediate context of this being that the Egyptians consider shepherds an abomination, why does Pharaoh put Jacob's family in charge of even Egypt's flocks if they don't like shepherds? Why would they do that?
Because of Joseph.
I think you're exactly right. It's got to be because of Joseph. That's kind of been the thing wherever Joseph has gone, that they could tell, hey, God's with him. That's why he put Joseph in charge. And you know, while some stranger who's a shepherd might not have any, you know, if some random stranger came up to Pharaoh and said, oh, please let us graze in your land, he'd be like, go talk to Joseph. You deal with this. And what was Joseph doing to all those folks? He was like, okay, if you give me all your livestock, we'll give you food and you'll basically be our servants, but you have to work for us. That was the deal everybody else was getting. What kind of deal did Joseph's family get? Joseph's family, despite being in the same situation as everyone else, they were said, oh, well, if any of your, you know, any of your brothers or any of their children are good shepherds, then, you know, put them in charge of my livestock as well. What I see is the same mentality was everything Joseph touches goes to gold. So if anybody's going to be able to multiply my livestock, it's going to be him and his family. So I'm going to put him in charge of my livestock as well. So again, with the theme here, yeah, it's because of Joseph. Why did Pharaoh trust Joseph so much? It's because of God. It's because of God. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, we know it's God's providence, but it really worked out in their favor that, you know, the Egyptians didn't want to deal with sheep, and that's exactly what they did. And they got to go there and get the best land and get the Egyptian flocks as well. And it's, you know, really all worked out in their favor.
Yeah, and until Joseph dies, when they forgot about Joseph and forgot about this deal that was made, and the people are enslaved. Yeah, I mean, in this time, everything's turning up their way, and they've been taken care of. And yeah, you're right, absolutely right. You can see God's providence in it. There's really no other way to explain why this would be. And I've often thought, well, you know, that's whenever they're in the land of Canaan and you have all the people that are there that they're not supposed to intermarry with, why, you know, what was the temptation but to assimilate with the Canaanite culture, assimilate with them, have children with them, intermarry with them? But what I see is God's plan, that he was trying to keep them separate, that he was trying to keep them pure, that he was trying to fulfill the promise made specifically to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now through Joseph. And I don't think it's a coincidence that as they're going into the land of Goshen, they're somewhat separate, right? The Egyptians are kind of keeping them at arm's length. I think that's on purpose. And I think that's according to God's plan as well, that he was trying to keep them pure. We see the providence of God in the way that he commands his people to be diligent scribes, to copy down and everything that we're not going to cover in Genesis. It's the culture of the Jews was supposed to be one that would usher in Jesus, one that would usher in the ultimate fulfillment of this plan, this promise that has been made from Abraham and passed down through the family. And we'll see before we wrap this up, you know, that they're still taking this seriously as it's going through Jacob's family that's now expanding. And we're going to see the tribes, we're going to see all this stuff. It's clear that even though during each one of these individuals' lifetimes, they can't see the whole picture of how these things are going to be fulfilled, that God has a plan, and it's all working out exactly as God planned. That, yeah, they're going to eat. Yeah, it's terrible that there's a famine, but God had provided for them by really no means of their own, not by their own cunning or their own brilliance. It was not something that they would have ever planned it out that way, to lose their son, to lose his son, and then, oh, found him again. Here he is, and he has all this food for us and all this provision for us. That wasn't how Jacob would have planned it, but that's how it worked out. And I just, you know, I always thought that was strange. You know, what? Why is this passage in here talking about how the Egyptians found, they didn't want to deal with the sheep, they didn't want to deal with the herds, they didn't want to be in charge of the livestock? Why did they find an abomination? I think it's for multiple purposes, and one of them was to keep them separate, and to keep them pure, to keep them holy, and to keep that lineage fresh. You know what? It probably would have been tempting just to stay in Egypt. You know, we got. In fact, that's when they're going to the Promised Land. That's exactly what a lot of them say. Hey, who is better in Egypt? I don't want to go. So I think it was important that. Yeah, imagine if they all had familial ties, all tied up with the Egyptians. Then they really wouldn't have wanted to go. Well, my aunt and my grandma and everybody else, they still live there. I don't want to go. Well, they were separate, and they stayed separate, so I thought that was interesting. Any other thoughts on that? So I thought this was interesting as well. So some guy who handles livestock, it's apparently an abomination to you. What blessing can he give to, you know, Almighty Pharaoh? Pharaoh, who is kind of the man, everybody's coming to him. They're super wealthy because they were the only ones who planned for this drought. How is it that Jacob is able to bless Pharaoh here? That's a question. Well, I'll give you the answer then. To me, what I see is a certain level of respect that Pharaoh has for Joseph. For Jacob and for Joseph. Though this is his daddy, right? I mean, the questions that he's asking, it almost seems to me like it's like a level of respect, admiration that you would speak. I don't know about Egyptian culture. I think in many cultures you respect your elders, as you should. What we see here is, you know, the question being asked. Joseph brought his father in, and it says that Jacob blessed Pharaoh, and Pharaoh asked Jacob, "How old are you?" You know, that's the first question that's asked is, "How old are you?" Almost see it as, I can't read into it inflection, but it seems like kind of a casual question you'd ask anybody. He seems genuinely interested in Jacob, and Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of my life, and they have not attained the days of the years of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage." So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. So twice it says that Jacob blesses Pharaoh. And I just felt like that's a very strange dynamic, that you come to a king begging for grain and you're the one who blesses him. How does that work? And so it makes me think, what does it mean by he blesses him? Well, for one, I think Pharaoh legitimately wants the blessings that come from this family and from God. And possibly as well, the interpretation of that could be that, you sing praises and blessings and honor to God, and he's above you. So could just be a sign of Jacob showing respect and thanks to Pharaoh for providing for him bread. But I guess the way that I've kind of looked at it, what we're going to see is, through all this, you know, Abraham, he blesses his son, Isaac. And Isaac, he blesses his son. And what we're going to see here shortly is Jacob's going to go around blessing his children and his grandchildren. And so I guess because of that, I don't know how y'all see it, but a lot of times in my mind, I have looked at blessings as, well, I have to be in a position to be able to bless you with something. So normally when someone's passing on a blessing, I think of the blessings that come from God. This Thanksgiving, I've had a lot of things to be thankful for. Hope you all counted your blessings as well. But I don't usually think of it as, my presence to you is just a blessing, and, me singing your praises or saying thank you is really that much of a blessing. I don't know. That's just the way I am. I don't really usually think of it that way. So, I guess I asked the question because I'm kind of torn between these. What does it mean that Jacob blessed Pharaoh? I guess it could mean either one of those things, but go ahead.
I don't know if this is why he blessed him, but it seems like, well, this Pharaoh understood who God was to an extent, had a respect for God, saw it in Joseph, and knew that God was with him. Whereas you look at when Joseph dies, the next Pharaoh coming up, has no respect for God, doesn't even want to acknowledge God, tries to explain his own God.
I think that's a good point, because Pharaoh was troubled by the dream he had, and when he didn't tell anybody what it was, and only Joseph knew, he knew that this was a real God. So I don't know if you chalk that up to superstition, real faith, or what, but he certainly did, to some extent, believe in God and believe in the blessings that came from God. So whether he's seeking a blessing from Jacob or Jacob was just singing his praises and being thankful, I guess either one of those makes sense. But any other thought? Go ahead.
I didn't really give this much thought before getting the question, but this is the patriarchal period, and it was basically the duty of the eldest of the family, which is the father, father, grandfather, whatever, to pass on blessings. They pretty much acted in the place of what would later become the priesthood for the family. They would offer the sacrifices for the family. Before their death, they would offer the blessings, but those were different because it was passing on your blessings to them, that may God do this for you, may God do this and everything, as far as inheritance and things like that. This is a little different, though. It's peculiar to me as well, but I can't help but think that because Pharaoh has, when God blesses us, he oftentimes uses others to bless us. Like when he told Abraham, I will be a blessing to you and you will be a blessing to many nations. In other words, through you, blessings will pour out to everyone. Pharaoh is one of those instruments that was used by God to be a blessing because of his belief, you know, your God. And it's not necessarily, I think it might be partially to what you were saying about superstition. Because in those days, there were beliefs in many gods, and there was more of a superstition. I don't want to offend this God, you know, your God or that God, because they may curse me or whatever. It wasn't a firm belief, otherwise he would have converted to just their God only. But here, instead of Pharaoh fearing a curse of a God, he now has a blessing. Joseph pronounces on him, and it's because, you know, his faithfulness to his family.
Yeah, I think this thing that we've been dancing around, what you're talking about, is the culture of the time. And you're absolutely right. You know, when you come, when we were reading previously in Genesis, and you'd have this kingdom warring against this kingdom, and they were basically just city-states going at it. Well, you're right. This was the patriarchal dispensation. This is when God would speak directly to the patriarchs of the family, and the culture of the time was what the leader, what the father, what the pinnacle says, that's what goes. What the patriarch says, that's what's going to be done, which is why we saw all of these, they were coveting the blessings that would come from their father. Why Jacob and Esau had some squabbles about that stuff was because that's the way their culture was. And so when you saw, you know, Melchizedek and all these other situations, I think they did seek blessings from each other. You know, oh, if I could find a blessing from somebody else. I doubt that it would have been as strange for them. The only reason I found it strange was, the main reason I found it strange was because apparently they didn't like shepherds, that he even allowed him in his presence. You know, you'd normally think he'd be like, I don't want to talk to that shepherd yet. You know, that Jacob even got an audience with Pharaoh was, in my mind, remarkable. But it was because of Joseph, and because, well, I think Pharaoh was a little bit interested in, oh, so you're telling me there's a patriarch even above Joseph that can give me a blessing? Then, hey, I'm all for it. So I think that's probably likely it, if you understand their culture a little bit better. And I think the reason why it seems strange, the reason I pose the question is because that's not really the way we always think about blessings in our society. Despite how some may claim, isn't really a patriarchy, isn't, at least not like them, not like it was back then. Good point. Anything else here? All right, and so this gets, I've already kind of alluded to this, you know, the rest of this describes how everybody else got treated during this famine, you know, when normally, you know, Pharaoh set him in charge. I doubt that people were bothering him with the day-to-day of everything. Pharaoh's just kind of sitting there up high on his throne, watching everybody come to him for grain and just letting his kingdom grow and grow and grow and getting really, really rich off of all of this. So that's because the way that Joseph managed all this, starting there in verse 13, the way that he dealt with the famine was there was no bread. And so when people came to him, verse 15, when the money failed in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came. So he was really even enslaving his own people. Everybody was coming to him, everybody from there and from the land of Canaan. In verse 14 as well, it says that. It says in verse 15 that when the money failed and in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread. Why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. And Joseph said, give your livestock and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they bought their livestock, brought their livestock to Joseph, and gave bread in exchange to their horses, their flocks, their cattle, their herds, their donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for their livestock that year. And when the year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, "We'll not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. My Lord, also our herds and our livestock. There is nothing left in the sight, my Lord, but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we will be our servants, and give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate." So I don't think people in modern America would go for this if we were going through a severe drought and we were trying to beg the government for some money, that we would want to be slaves. But here, they had no choice. So I don't know if you'd consider this to be cutthroat or not, but they bought grain until their money ran out. They couldn't really make any more money because the land, the famine was so severe, they really weren't able to make more money. So when they ran out of money, they bought all their livestock and bought all their property. And when they had nothing left to sell, they sold themselves. And so it was essentially indentured servitude, where you could stay on your land, but it's my land now, and you work on it for me. You are my servant now. And so everyone else was getting this deal. And again, you remember that wasn't the original deal that Joseph's family got, but eventually they kind of get roped in this too when they forget about who Joseph was towards the end. So, I don't know. I don't know if you all think that's kind of cutthroat. Maybe for our society, that seems a little harsh. Slavery and indentured servitude is not really looked well upon in our society. People value freedom almost beyond anything else. I think a lot of people in this country would rather die than be a slave. But these people here, they swallowed their pride and said, "Oh, there's no reason for us to die. You know, if we can live, you provide us the seed, and we'll work for you and produce what we can for you." So that's how the empire, and that's how Egypt became as powerful as it was, and how it got so many slaves. So, you wonder how they built the pyramids. This is how they owned everybody. That's the way it was. Everybody in the region worked for them. So God provided for them in such a powerful way that, no one else saw it coming. Only Egypt did. And if you got the food and no one else does, if that doesn't show the power and wisdom of God, I don't know what else does. You make the rules, and that's the way it went. So, chapter 48, though, the focus remains to me on the plan. The focus remains to me, what we talked about earlier was Jacob's kind of hesitant. He's not really sure if he wants to leave Canaan, the promised land, and wants to go to Egypt. Well, God, you promised me this land. Well, God tells him to go, and he's focused, you see, we're going to see. On his deathbed, he is still focused on returning to that land and having those promises fulfilled. This is really true to Jacob's character. If you can remember back to when we were talking more so, and the focus was on Jacob. He really wanted that spiritual blessing. He really wanted and valued that idea of being God's chosen people and having a covenant with God. And I think the focus shifts back there onto the covenant here. And so as Jacob is getting ready to pass and sets affairs in order, he's really emphasizing this with his family. So what does he emphasize to Joseph on his deathbed? Verses 3 through 6. Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And he said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply, and I will make you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession.' And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you, came to you in Egypt are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they are mine. Your offspring whom you beget after you, after them shall be yours, and they will be called the name of their brothers in their inheritance. So a significant moment here. A long time coming through being sold off into slavery, the dreams, everyone coming and bowing down to him. Here what we see is the son of promise is now Joseph. And I always found it a little bit strange that all the other sons were, you know, a tribe each, but Joseph kind of got two tribes through his children. But anyways, we'll pick up there next week, and we'll probably finish through chapter 50, and I'll have a new plan for us of looking at these prophecies and fulfillments in the New Testament, ready to go through, hopefully through the end of the year. We'll have a plan out, and I'll get those out to you. So thank you.